This podcast is for educational purposes only. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect the official policy or position of the Ted Stevens Center, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
So the U.S. Department of Defense released a new Arctic strategy in 2024. In it, it directs the department to enhance its Arctic capabilities, deepen engagement with allies and partners, and exercise U.S. forces to build readiness for operations at high latitudes. It defines the strategic environment mostly through the context of the People's Republic of China and Russian activities in the Arctic, including their growing cooperation, the enlargement of NATO, and the increasing effects of climate change, heralding in a new and more dynamic Arctic security environment. The strategy then lists the PRC, not the Russian Federation, not climate change, not developing infrastructure, but the PRC as the number one priority. You wrote an article in Foreign Policy magazine that disagrees with that. And I'm curious to know how you came to that conclusion and maybe your overall thoughts on the strategy itself. Because you do point out some good elements and some elements that maybe need a little more rethinking. Paul?
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Alison. There was a colleague of mine, Yuengi Beckel, who's a China scholar at our institute, who actually came up with the idea, and it was very much sort of triggered by the publication of the strategy, but also in more in general terms, the increasing focus on China in U.S. Arctic policy in general, and also the letter that the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party in Congress sent to the DOD and State Department earlier, as in last autumn, was also a thing that sort of made the topic more relevant. So basically, what we saw when reading the strategy is that this is the first strategy that really puts China front and center the Pentagon's sort of Arctic strategies. The previous iterations the first one didn't mention China at all, and then gradually, China got more space, but it has never before been sort of the main thing in the Pentagon Arctic strategy. And basically, we think that it's a good strategy in the sense that it sort of states a clear objective, and then it sort of has the ways that the U.S. should how it should reach those goals. But we sort of saw two pitfalls, two things that worried us when in that strategy, and the first one is that we think it overemphasizes China in the sense that it exaggerates the influence and the position China has in the Arctic. But China is a global power, and increasingly so, and it wields a lot of influence a lot of the places in the world. And just sort of take Africa as an example. The lure of Chinese investments and big loans without any strings attached has sort of gained China a lot of influence there. But the Arctic is very different. First of all, the Arctic states, as in the coastal states, four or five of those are strong democratic states and NATO members. Those are obviously, as you know, the United States, Canada, Denmark/Greenland, and Norway. And the last coastal state is Russia. And even if you expand that number to the members of the Arctic Council, you include Iceland, Sweden, and Finland, you get seven democracies, NATO members, and only one that stands on the outside. And all of the democratic states in the Arctic have become increasingly wary and even suspicious of Chinese investments. So it's not easy for China to get a foothold in the Arctic. And the only way it really can do that is through Russia. And obviously now Russian influence, Chinese influence over Russia probably increasing a lot with all the support that China provides to Russia in its war against Ukraine, then as in China will have a lot of opportunities to gain influence in the Russian Arctic, but still there's quite a step from that to naming China as the main threat or the main challenge in the Arctic, because it is not as we see it.
So that's that's that, you identified two of the pitfalls in
yeah, that was the first one. Yeah,
that was the first one, and the second one is basically if you overemphasize the Chinese position in the Arctic, at the same time you're saying that you're actually underemphasizing Russia's position there. So maybe you could comment in a little bit on that, but also in the response, perhaps you could share the risks of either overemphasizing China or the risks of underemphasizing Russia in the Arctic or just with Arctic affairs writ large.
Yeah, first on Russia, as in Russia is by far the biggest Arctic state, and it is that out of geography, because the Russian Federation covers more than 40% of the Arctic coastline. So based on international law, Russia can rightfully claim a large chunk of the Arctic, almost up to sort of half the Arctic ocean can be claimed by Russia. So Russia has a lot to sort of, is very influential for that reason in Arctic affairs. And cooperation in the Arctic context makes very little sense without Russia. Moreover, as in a Pentagon strategy, you should have imagined, you should expect that it emphasizes the military threats. Mm-hmm. And it's really only the Russian Navy that is based on the Kola Peninsula and the sort of strategic submarines with long range nuclear missiles that constitutes any kind of military threat or significant military threat against the United States in the Arctic. Nothing else really does that, and China isn't present in the Arctic at all. So just out of that, you should expect that Russia should be front and center in any sort of Defense Department strategy. Now, if you go beyond the strategy and the politics, then and look at what the United States actually does in the Arctic, I'm the second point and the second pitfall is not, in my eyes, really that big, because the U.S. is sort of engaged in collecting intelligence and following sort of Russian Navy and whatever Russia does in the Arctic. So I'm not too afraid now, but if this sort of the emphasis on China and the you could even call it a obsession with China in the Arctic continues, then there is of course a risk that attention to Russia will sort of be replaced by following something that really doesn't constitute, in my eyes at least, a serious threat against the United States.
Could identifying China as the main threat, and maybe threat's not the right word, but could this be unintentionally a circuitous way of messaging to Russia that it's over-leveraged by the PRC towards its, maybe not Arctic initiatives, but for its sort of its standing, its ability to continue to wage war in Ukraine, its ability to maintain a viable economy by way of exporting oil and gas primarily to China? I don't think that's the deliberate intention of the strategy, but is that maybe an unintended outcome of it? And if so, is there even any value in that?
No, it's an interesting thought, as in, I think the main reason why you have this strong emphasis on China is that China has been identified by the national defense strategy of the United States as the pacing threat. So that sort of flows down into underlying strategies that also have to sort of point towards China as the main challenge. Given what you said is interesting in the sense that it does sort of at least message to Russia that we are not really concerned about you. It's China that is our concern. And even in the Arctic context, sort of you are now the little brother or the sort of the small bully on the block, and China is the big one. I don't think that, as you said, is intentional, but it could be read like that in Moscow, which I guess would be a good thing. You don't need to sort of increase Russian self-confidence these days.
And so, Paul, what are you to make of the Chinese-Russian collaboration in in that particular sphere of the world, and I kind of would call it the North Pacific, we could call it this sort of intersection of the Arctic and the Pacific. Some have referred to it as joint campaigning, not so much as interoperability. What are you to make of what has transpired here? I sit in Alaska, so it's you know closer to me than it is to you physically, yep. Where these events have occurred. But someone who's followed the issue for some time, what are you to make of it?
I'm not a sort of an expert on either China or Russia, but my clear impression is that this is more political messaging than actual sort of real and sort of substantial military cooperation. Basically, they fly alongside each other and they sail alongside each other. There's no interoperability or sort of any kind of ability to operate together in a sort of operate a military operational way. So it's messaging the United States that we are this together and we are cooperating and the sort of showing off of Alaska is apparently a new thing they do together. As you had vessels sailing up through the Bering Strait and planes as in bombers flying together. So, and this is a point we make in the article as well, in this sense, the strategy becomes basically the sort of placing Alaska in the strategic rivalry with China. It sort of Alaska is the Arctic element of the U.S. competition with China, because this is where you meet China increasingly often, it seems.
Yeah, it seems so. About 4 years ago, the Chinese came up to Alaska to conduct their first bilateral meeting with the United States right downtown at the Hotel Captain Cook, and it seemed that at the time that the Chinese were more than glad to have been part of a meeting here in Alaska. That's maybe for a different conversation. I liken sometimes some of the conversation about Russia in China off the coast of the U.S. Arctic, off of Alaska, is maybe to a football field. It could be football as you see it in Norway, or football as we see it in the United States. Same metaphor applies, where for a long time the ball has been down on their end of the field, and we're used to playing in that side of the field, that zone. And maybe this is messaging where actually, no, we can play a little bit on your end of the field and be a little bit more defensive. What resources do we need to develop in order to not have that so close to our goal line or the red zone or what might that be? With that in mind, we've developed an initiative here at the Stevens Center called the Arctic Pacific Security Dialogue to talk about this exact issue, about this nexus between the Arctic and the Pacific. And it's not just the area off the coast, say, of Alaska and the U.S. Arctic, the Bering Sea specifically. While that is the area that we have seen the joint campaigning, but quite literally, the Arctic-Pacific nexus, when we talk about the circumpolar Arctic, and while Norway might not be physically, say, as close to the Bering Sea as the U.S. Arctic, that's not to say Norway doesn't have interests in the Pacific region as just a nation unto itself. And when I visited you in September, I believe your prime minister was in China at that same time. And then when I last spoke to you, or one of the last few times we chatted, you had just returned from Taiwan, which is two examples of how Norway has interests in the region. So maybe we could just start a little bit about tying Norway to the Pacific and what some of those interests are, what the prime minister was talking about, and then maybe you could develop that into this nexus between the Arctic and the Pacific. What are some of the intersecting issues that we're paying attention to now?
Yeah, no, as in all of these are examples that we live in a global world, and the whole world is connected, and you can see that in the Arctic in many senses. For a long time there was this notion of Arctic exceptionalism, that the Arctic was sort of a place removed from everything else and isolated from the sort of the ebbs and flows of global politics, but it's not anymore. It's clearly become much more part of world politics. And also the sort of Asia Pacific theater or the Asia Pacific region has become increasingly interlinked in many ways with also the sort of the European part of the world. And the prime minister going to as a Norwegian prime minister going to China obviously had lots of reasons, but the key one is that Norway is one of the countries in Europe that sort of places a lot of emphasis on trading with China. Norway is a small country with a very open economy, and we're basically dependent on international trade. That said, also Norway has become increasingly wary of China, and there have been attempts by Chinese investors, for instance, to sort of buy property on Svalbard or invest in a port in northern Norway. Both of those probably linked to ambitions that China had for enabling it, at least long-term shipping through the Arctic. And this is just sort of shows how issues that China in Asia Pacific directly connects to issues close to Norway up here in the north. And it's also vice versa. And that was why I was in Taiwan, because a lot of Asian countries, including Taiwan, but Japan, South Korea, even Singapore and India, have become interested in the Arctic, and several of them, all of those mentioned, except from Taiwan, have sort of become members or observers in the Arctic Council. Like, why do they do that? Well, they see opportunities, shipping, etc. But also, it's my clear impression that a lot of these countries sort of pay attention to the Arctic because they see China doing it. And it's also a way of keeping track of what China is doing by sort of being themselves interested in the Arctic, and obviously many other places in the world. So the world is connected, and the Arctic has become one of the issues that sort of connects the North Pacific and the North Atlantic region.
Yeah, that's interesting. You point out that there might be some inherent interest from some of the Pacific nations in the Arctic itself. You point out some countries there, Taiwan, Singapore, India. You could throw Japan and Korea into that mix. Japan's had a long science focus in the Arctic. India as well. You can draw connections between changing environmental patterns in which could impact the monsoon. It's a way of life in India. A little bit of sea level rise could impact millions and millions of people there. But you also bring up an interesting point that from a geopolitical level, not just necessarily from, say, an economic level, from an independent or an individual state itself, that these Pacific nations would be interested in the Arctic because China's interested in the Arctic. What specifically might they be looking for in China's interests in the Arctic region itself? Is it the same for all of them? Is it a little bit different? What is it that they would be paying attention to as China has increased, to use some other people's words, increased its activities scientifically and otherwise in the Arctic region?
I don't know if I can answer that very concretely and specifically, but I, as in, there are also sort of other reasons why these countries, as in particularly South Korea and Japan, are interested, and those are the same as China, and shipping is one. Now, the expectations that you've seen for many years about sort of increased commercial shipping through the Arctic have clearly been exaggerated. As in, if you go 15 years back in time, a lot of people were claiming that the Arctic is going to take over from the Suez Canal as the main shipping route, et cetera, et cetera. Clearly, that hasn't happened, and it's very, very far from happening if it's ever going to take place. But still, it's on alternative routes that over time probably will become more viable and commercially interesting. And a lot of these countries in the Asia Pacific are interested because they want to export goods to Europe and North America. South Korea in particular has a strong shipbuilding industry that has built a lot of ice-strengthened ships, including for Russia, before sanctions kicked in 2022. So there are sort of industrial interests in these countries as well. But as I said, it is my clear impression that part of their interest is sort of triggered by Chinese activity, and Chinese interest in developing its sort of so-called Polar Silk Road, which is part of its wider Belt and Road Initiative, but also Chinese investment in Russia in oil and gas and sort of its interest in other resources in the Arctic.
It seems like a lot of the conversations about Arctic shipping, you know, immediately start to focus on the Northern Sea Route, and it's understandable because that's a lot of where the shipping would occur, at least proximate to it. Sometimes that fails to address where shipping currently exists now, and there was a recent example when the Suez Canal, shipping through the Red Sea and into the Suez Canal, decreased by about, I think it was up to 90% at one point because of the instability the Houthi rebels were placing in the region. So 90% of shipping stops going through that particular choke point and needs to go elsewhere. Now I think the preponderance of shipping then went around the Horn of Africa and all the way around the longer way. I don't have the data on how much may have been diverted, call it east and then north along the Northern Sea Route, but you could maybe draw some connections between the possibilities of that being a possibility in the future if indeed other routes were not viable. And then connect the national interests of the nations that you put together there, India, Singapore, Taiwan, and you look at either, you know, South Korean shipbuilding, or you look at the amount of people, seafarers, mariners that are of the Indian nationality, and you start to see why some of these countries are not only members of the Arctic Council, but are interested in what other nations are interested in the Arctic region. Paul, I think you brought up some good points here that as we look to expand our Arctic Pacific security dialogue, these are some of the issues that I think we want to try to look into more closely, because it's not always just an Arctic thing, as you know. It's a global thing that sometimes just needs an Arctic lens. So with that in mind, you started part of this this tranche of the conversation about how the Arctic is now more part of world politics. Maybe we're beyond an era of Arctic exceptionalism. Maybe it's somewhere out in the future. But we'll pause on that notion for a second and just agree that the Arctic is certainly part of world politics. And we saw that a little bit in the headlines when President Trump had mentioned Greenland in the context of geopolitical affairs. And to me, it was emblematic of the importance and how the Arctic has been integrated into geopolitical affairs these days. It would be interesting to more specifically understand the role that Greenland currently plays in Arctic security and governance from your perspective, Paul. Sometimes the headlines focus on one thing, but maybe you can pull out some details for us to just help us better understand either Greenland's role or just some of the role that the Arctic writ large is playing. Maybe start with Greenland.
Yeah, happy to. There are primarily two reasons that Greenland is important, and both of them have been present in the debate, and President Trump has referenced them several times as well. First is geography, as in the location of Greenland. And this is the sort of historical reason why you saw an interest from the U.S. develop towards Greenland during the Cold War. And the reason why Greenland's geography is important is the same in many ways as the same reason why Alaska is important. And it's because a lot of the trajectories of long-range bombers and long-range missiles, if directed or flying towards the United States, would go through the Arctic, because the enemies shooting this are on the other side of the globe, and thus the shortest route would be across the top of the world. This obviously was the case for Soviet Union and later Russia, but even countries like Iran, if Iran developed missiles that could reach the United States, they would come up over Europe and across and sort of up towards Greenland and then down into the United States. And similarly, on the Asia Pacific side, missiles from North Korea and China would also go up north before coming down south again. It's not a coincidence that you have Fort Greely and the missile as a missile defense base up in Alaska. Now, on the green on the other side, as in on Greenland, it's sort of it's you don't have missile defense sort of missiles, but you have the radar at Pituffik, or which used to be called Thule, and it's probably well better known as the Thule radar. So this is sort of the first and main strategic military strategic reason why Greenland is important, because it's sort of it's part of the geography that is important for the hemispheric defense of North America. Now the second reason is more recent, in the sense that it hasn't been it wasn't the focus during Cold War, but it has become so in the last decade plus. And that's the sort of the rich resources on Greenland, the expectations and even sort of evidence that there are a lot of rare earths and other sort of valuable minerals. And a third sort of a factor that is linked to particularly to the second part, but also to somewhat to the first element, as in the geographic important, is that Greenland is a very it's a big island, but very with a very, very small population, about sort of 60,000 people or something live on Greenland. And a lot of Greenlanders want to become independent, become their own country. That has not been possible because of the economic situation, as in Greenland does not have enough money to make it on its own. It is very dependent on money it gets from Denmark. Denmark provides something like 460 million or something US dollars, if I remember right. $640 million, which represents something like one fifth of the Greenlandic GDP and a large share of its government revenue. So without some kind of source of money, Greenland cannot become independent. The worry has then been that China would come and offer the Greenlanders a lot of money, as in to invest large sums of money into mines or other kinds of economic activity, and that China through that would gain influence and basically sort of take over Greenland, as I guess President Trump would say. Now, this has not happened, and the attempts we've seen from China to invest big on Greenland, particularly there was a few years ago when Chinese offered to finance the development of the new airport at Nuuk, which is the capital on Greenland. That was stopped by partly the United States telling Denmark that it should be aware of this, and then partly also the government in Copenhagen going in and advising the Greenlanders not to accept this deal. I've also read that it wasn't a good enough offer anyway, so the Greenlanders weren't going to take it at any rate. But the point is here is this, that there are outsiders. So Denmark, as part of the as the leading part of the Commonwealth of Denmark, but also United States, that are actively monitoring and following developments on Greenland. So the risk of China and Russia taking over, in my eyes, is very, very remote. But obviously, there is an opportunity here for both the Greenlanders, but also if you want to take President Trump's side, that if the United States offers more money than Denmark does, then Greenland might lean towards the United States. Now, I don't really understand what the U.S. would gain from sort of making Greenland an associate state or a part of the United States, because in my eyes, there is nothing that the U.S. cannot achieve today that it would be able to achieve if the status of Greenland was changed. If the United States wants to open another military base on Greenland, I don't see the Greenlanders or Denmark protesting against that. And even less so if US companies wanted to develop a mine and sort of extract rare earths on Greenland, that I think would be very much welcomed by Greenlanders. So there is something to the importance of Greenland, but I think it's somewhat exaggerated, to put it like that, by this new administration.
Paul, you bring up a lot of good points here. I mean, and sometimes I direct people back to the bilateral defense agreement that the United States has in this regard. Also, Greenland, as a being part of the Kingdom of Denmark, is part of the NATO infrastructure. You frame this very interestingly by pointing out sort of three areas in which we can understand this, the first being that Greenland's geography, and as I mentioned, its alignment is part of NATO and the bilateral defense agreement, places it front and center within missile defense, but also within just, call it, nuclear deterrence strategy that maybe a lot of people now aren't as familiar with as we would have been back during the Cold War, when there was a maybe much more front and center threat. And that still exists out there in the world, as we see both Russia and China have capabilities. And you even mentioned Iran, not to mention North Korea. And so how Greenland could play a role in sort of a deterrence or a missile defense strategy is one way to look at it. Second, of course, you pointed out resources and just the inherent resources that exist in that particular place that would be of value to people who want them, but also, as you mentioned, to kind of get to your third point, economically, it is something that Greenland could develop in order to develop a more viable economic infrastructure, but also to serve those who might want the call it product or the resource. That being said, what more could be done to either strengthen relationships, strengthen ties, to make it a mutually beneficial? And maybe the question could be framed in the context of NATO, perhaps, and just focus more on the defense side of it. Does there need to be more militarily done in your eyes, having been, part of Norwegian leadership within NATO, within Arctic initiatives, and you see Greenland now and talking about maybe we do need to put more military there. In your eyes, is that necessary? Are there avenues there to improve the security situation, or perhaps maybe we just need to better educate people on what actually is there?
I don't really see any pressing needs on sort of to strengthen military presence on Greenland. There are several aspects of this. One is the one we talked about now, as in the hemispheric defense of North America and sort of missile defense of radars and stopping long-range bombers, etc. That, for the North American part, that's not really NATO. It's not NATO. It's NORAD and the bilateral Canadian-U.S. cooperation with sort of the bilateral agreement with Greenland as a sort of addition to that. Because in that sense, Greenland sort of forms part of the North American continent. Another part of the picture is the North Atlantic and the long Greenlandic coast sort of facing eastwards. And there, obviously, it could be sort of potentially interesting to develop listening stations, as in to look for submarines, as in put out cables and acoustic cables, etc. But NATO, like during the Cold War, the sort of NATO's main line of defense in the maritime sense is a bit further south, and it's in the GIUK gap, as it's called, right? Greenland, Iceland, UK gap, where the North Atlantic is somewhat more shallow, and it's sort of easier to detect submarines if they come down there. So in that sense, given that the Russian Navy is not what the Soviet Navy was, it's much, much smaller, and there's a limited number of submarines that need to be tracked, I don't really sort of see a big need for big investments into Greenlandic defense. Now, what the Greenlanders would welcome, as I've noted, and which seems sort of perhaps more interesting, is some kind of sort of joint effort or sort of US-led effort, whatever, to extract rare earth minerals and through that lessen our dependence on China. That could be interesting. There are sort of obviously other places as well where you can find rare earths, but this would, in a way, provide an opportunity for the Greenlanders and be very beneficial for them. And interesting for the United States, because you get it very close to home, in a sense, because it's not that far away. So that could be an idea. I think that's more, in a sense, more interesting than the military side of the of this question?
Well, it's a good way to connect the dots between, say, if the goal is security, maybe the first step isn't necessarily in this context more defense-related security, but starting with economic security and saying, well, this is the need, this is maybe what's at threat, or this is where there's an opportunity. That's maybe a thread that we could pull on for a different conversation. Thanks for bringing up some of those issues. You started to talk a little bit about the Russian capabilities in the Arctic, and at the risk of bouncing around a little bit too much, I do want to give a little bit of airtime towards Norway's leadership in the High North, as it's often referred to in Norway. We might call it the Arctic, generally the same theater. Norway's a leader. It's also a target. It's an ally of the United States, of course. It's part of leader. It's a part of NATO. It's a leader of NATO, notably in the High North, as I mentioned. But that's not to say there's not it's all quiet necessarily up there in the European High North, notably near Norway. What are some things that you can bring to people's attention that might not be following activities that might fall below the threshold of conflict, but yet are still either threatening, disruptive? You talked about cables. Of course, we read oftentimes about cables being cut either in the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, elsewhere. But there's more than that. So maybe you could share a little bit about what is actually happening up in your neck of the woods.
Norway has been sort of the target of what you could call sort of gray zone or hybrid Russian activities, as Norway has along with other NATO countries that border Russia. And what we've seen is a sort of GPS jamming, spoofing originating from the Kola Peninsula that has caused traffic, as in problems for commercial flights in northern Norway. You've seen sort of Russian, primarily a few years back, you saw a lot of pronouncement of what are called NOTAMs, as in Notice to Airmen, air exclusion zones, where Russia basically said that we're going to have a missile or sort of firing exercise with our naval vessels, and you have to vacate this airspace. And they would declare a zone like that just off the coast of Norway. And once even close to the oil fields and oil and gas fields in the North Sea, which obviously then disrupted helicopter traffic to and from those platforms. And it's quite clearly these sort of moves like that are not intended sort of as real as in necessary exercises or anything. They're meant to sort of prod Norway or irritate Norway or sort of provoke a reaction from Norway to basically, well, in a sense, I guess, destabilize and cause political trouble. So, but Norway has not, as in generally, Norway has not been the country in Europe that has been most exposed to this. Leaving aside countries like Moldova, which has been a lot of sort of negative Russian attention, the Baltic Sea has and the Baltic countries, and now even Finland has received more problems like this than Norway has, from our perspective. Fortunately, so,
So my question was going to be a follow-up to that. No, yeah. I was going to ask if this is more of a domestic issue or an international security concern, but what you just mentioned towards the end there is saying that, sure, it could be maybe perceived as a domestic issue within Norway, but it's not necessarily only happening there. So there's parallels between hybrid or gray zone activities that Russia is doing, and so it's in that regard maybe not so much domestic. It is international security. Would you agree?
It is definitely.
Okay.
One thing I was going to say that I sort of remembered now is that one thing you've seen in Norway, which is not unique, but it's a bit special and sort of not seen so much, I think, at least so frequently in other countries, is something called memorial diplomacy, where Russian officials have sort of abused, one could say, war memorials and sort of commemorations of the war dead. And sort of there have been sort of these annual events where we've sort of marked the liberation of Finnmark, which is the northernmost county of Norway, where you've seen Russian officials using that for propaganda purposes. And this has been, in a sense, also been a domestic issue in Norway, more or less until 2022, where you saw a shift in sort of in the mood in Norway as well, where you had the sort of a difference between people living in northern Norway, which had much more contact with Russia, but also and also sort of economic interest in trading and having contact across the border, and people in southern Norway that were more sort of distant from this and more skeptical to sort of contacts with and interaction with Russia. And this memorial diplomacy ended up in sort of in the middle of this. But then with the full scale of invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, basically this all changed. And now even in northern Norway now, there are very, very few who sort of want to go back to having good the relations we had with Russia before the war started. And just to go on, sort of, just to go on a little bit on that, you could sort of cut this. But one thing I think also that it is important to understand when you compare Norway to, for instance, both Finland, but also the Baltic states and Poland, is the very different history. Both as in the three Baltic states and Poland and Finland have all been attacked by the Soviet Union, were all attacked by the Soviet Union in the 20th century. Norway has never been at war with Russia. And at the end of the World War, as in World War II, in 1944, Soviet troops liberated the northernmost part of Norway and then withdrew. Mm. So there has long been this sort of sense in Norway, this mixed feeling, if you can call it that, in Norway, where on the one hand, Russia and the Soviet Union before that has clearly been the big threatening neighbor, the superpower that threatens Norway. And this is why Norway entered NATO and looked towards the United States as its main ally. But on the other side, there has also been this sort of perception and in a sense, in many ways, also a reality of a neighbor with shared interests with Norway and a shared history that is peaceful. And that helps explain why Norwegian policy towards Russia has been somewhat different than you would find in Finland, the Baltic states, and Poland, and even Sweden, actually, which also has a history of a war with Russia, but going further back.
Well, the Finns will always point out the colorful history that has existed between the two, and I'm glad you brought up history in all of this. As we wrap up, we've talked about Greenland and Norway, NATO, Russia, China, the Pacific. We talked about the U.S. strategy. That's how we initiated the conversation. I'm wondering if you had an opportunity to provide some advice on those that would be falling in on the U.S. Arctic strategy, what you might say. A lot of thought and time went into the new DoD Arctic strategy. What might you share in given what you've said here today?
Difficult question. I guess I'd sort of. I think that the main sort of recommendation or sort of the main strategy in the sense that comes or the main means that come out of the strategy that I forget the words now. I don't have it in front of me, but sort of it's what is it? Observe and react or something like that.
Monitor and respond. I believe it was
monitor and respond. It is, yes, yeah. As in the monitor respond, I think is it's a sort of a moderate or sort of call it level-headed approach to challenges that we see might develop in the Arctic, because. As I've been trying to say, I don't see the Arctic as the potential site for World War III by any stretch of the imagination. As in, the Arctic is in general, compared to most sort of other ocean areas, the South China Sea, the Black Sea, not the least now, but even the Eastern Mediterranean, the Arctic Ocean and the area around the Arctic Ocean is pretty well governed and stable region, and is also a region where there is very, very little activity compared to all of those others, as in, because it's mainly empty. There's no population, there's no one. There's wilderness in most of the Arctic. So I don't see sort of the big challenges emerging from the Arctic. There are connected to developments in the Arctic as such. There's a lot that sort of potentially in the long run that sort of could come to the Arctic from the outside. Trouble will start outside and then spread to the Arctic. This I see, but I don't see sort of big a war or a big conflict starting in the Arctic. And this is why I think that sort of the monitor and respond emphasis is a wise one. But I would sort of, as we started off with, I would recommend that to tone down the emphasis on China and sort of put the spotlight back on Russia, and the consequences that come from climate change, including the sort of the increasing difficulties in maintaining bases in Alaska, erosion, et cetera, that there are present now as well, but were more the focus in the previous strategies.
Dr. Paul Hilda, thanks so much for all your comments here today. We enjoyed having you on the program.
Thank you for having me.